Scott Weinberg is a veteran film critic. Steven DeGennaro is a doctor of astrophysics. Listen in as these two nerds compare and contrast two noteworthy sci-fi films every week. They'll discuss the artistic quality of the films, whether they get the science right, and whether or not that even matters. Welcome to Science vs. Fiction.
Hey, welcome back to another episode of Science vs. Fiction, the podcast in which we try to discuss science and movies and how they relate to one another cohesively or non-cohesively, as will be the case in one of the two films we discuss today. One of the films, very good. The other film, not very. As always, I am joined by my illustrious co-host, the very intelligent Dr. Steven DeGennaro. Hi, Steve.
Hello, Scott.
How are you, dude? What's going on?
Oh, you know, I was super excited to revisit one of these movies and less than excited to revisit the other one, but we'll talk about that in a second.
The first movie that we are going to discuss is one that it's been on our list since day one.
This pairing in particular has been on our list since day one.
Yeah, well, this is a film that you love in particular. We'll save that B film for a second. But you, when we first discussed both films we were going to cover and then pairings.
Well, you know, this is one of our episodes where we do a movie versus one of its sequels. It's the 13th and the 18th entries in the Apollo series. And as with all movies, eventually, you know, once you get enough sequels, they always go to space. You know, we did it with Jason. We did it with Leprechaun. And so the Apollo series finally made it into space by episode 13 and then stayed there for the next five. So,
all right. So you have like a hat full of Apollo 18 jokes and you're just going to throw them all at the wall at the same time.
Basically.
What else you got? Will I be able to understand Apollo 18 if I missed 16?
No, you don't really need 16. 17, so 18 is a direct sequel to 17. So you kind of need to see 17 in the same way you need to see like Casino Royale before you watch Quantum of Solace. Although I don't recommend watching either Apollo 18 or Quantum of Solace. So,
correct me if I'm mistaken, Steven, but we thought this might be a fun pairing because we have a very good film versus a not very good film.
Yep.
They both deal in the same story in that people are going to the moon, in theory.
Yep.
They also deal with two things that we really love. We both love space adventure, and we both do love found footage.
Yep.
So, you know, that we just thought that would be a fun pairing. And alphabetically, it just makes sense. Multiple Apollos. As Steven's stand-up routine informed us. But now, why don't you just give our listeners a little background on why this movie hit you in such a personal way and why you've seen it so many times and why you love it, beyond just, I'm an astrophysicist and I like Apollo 13.
I mean, you know, I wanted to be an astronaut. That was what I wanted to do when I was, when I was like a little kid. When I was in high school and college, I wanted to be an astronaut, and was at one point thinking about actually training to do that. And this movie came out when I was a senior in high school. I remember very, very distinctly going to see it with my girlfriend in high school and promising her that I would name a mountain on Mars after her when I was the first man on Mars. About halfway through my college career, I realized that I didn't have the, what's the word I'm looking for? Stick-to-itiveness. To go through what it takes to become an astronaut, to do what I needed to do on the academic side in order to do that. And I also did not, I realized that I have, major anxiety disorder and do not like the idea of being stuck in a tin can for weeks on end with absolutely no means of escape. Like, I don't even like being in my car in like a drive-through where there's a car in front of you and behind you and you can't get out.
Yeah.
That gives me enough anxiety. So the idea, I met this astronaut who went to my college and had came back to give a talk or whatever and was talking to him about it. And he was telling me about how there was one exercise that they did during the astronaut training where they basically zipped them inside a glorified duffel bag, like a 2 foot in any direction sphere of fabric. And just left them in there without telling them when they were going to come back or when they could get out. And they just had to kind of sit in there for as long as they needed to stay in there, for as long as they were left in there. And I was like, nope, I'm out.
Yeah, it sounds to me like a very uniquely difficult combination of physical difficulty and psychological difficulty.
Yeah. I mean, it requires a massive amount of mental discipline.
Right. There are lots of jobs that require physical distress for a while, like standing on your feet for 8 hours. That's not easy. You know what I mean? But it doesn't have, you know, but this is like concentrated everything, yeah. Physical, mental, you know, emotional, and the, like you said, the idea that even on your very best day with every machine and every human working at top level, you're still a few inches away from the vastness of space, yep. And that's scary.
Yeah, no, and that's what this movie gets right is 100% is two things that this movie gets right that the other movie we're going to talk about most definitely does not. One of them is that sense of being trapped in this place, and if things go wrong. Like you have to find solutions to them, and that, you know, and the teamwork aspect of them on board and also the people on the ground, all working together to try to solve this problem and bring them home. But definitely that sense of claustrophobia, that sense of like three guys stuck in a tin can together, starting to get sort of mad at each other, and being trapped. And then the other thing that it gets right is that despite that, you know, with the exception of a few moments here and there, they don't freak out, right? They're never panicked. They're always, okay, what's the problem? We have to solve this problem. This is bad. Things are very bad right now. But, you know, they are such mentally stable people and they have trained so heavily for this that when things go wrong, you know, their first instinct is not, oh my God, everything's going wrong. What are we going to do? You know, and somebody has to slap somebody across the face, pull yourself together, you know.
Right. It's always a part of it that, like, I assume that in the Air Force and in NASA in particular, in those two fields, you have to be trained in that mental acuity.
You have to, yeah.
You don't just draft somebody who happens to be stoic and calm under pressure. You draft them, and then you also train them to be that you know, authority. Even if you're terrified inside, you have to be, you know, the leader,
yeah.
The guy or the girl in charge at the moment. It's terrifying.
I think it's both. I think you absolutely have to have somebody who is constitutionally already built that way. You know, you can't be a test pilot if you're the kind of person who –
Right, you couldn't
out.
Turn me into a Neil Armstrong
right.
person.
No amount of training could turn you or I, which is what I realized, that there was no amount of training that was going to turn me into that kind of person. The kind of person who right. their spaceship explodes and, you know, their reaction is the very understated, Houston, we've had a problem. Not, holy crap, it just exploded.
You talked a bit about, like, when it came out, and I'm sure you, as well as I, both remember that one of the real big talking points in interviews, reviews, and any time you talked about this movie was the scientific veracity, the truth,
yeah,
the no shortcuts were taken, no BS. And as a guy who is, you know, more interested in movies being fun and entertaining than in being documentaries, I was like, hey, doesn't that potentially rob some of the suspense? And that's the beauty of this movie is,
yeah.
You know, anybody who has even a small dollop of history knowledge knows that these men get home alive.
Yeah.
But it's still a ridiculously and enjoyably suspenseful movie,
yeah.
Because it's the how,
yeah.
You know, it's the process.
Well, and in this case, I even knew most of the how. And that is another thing that this movie just, you know, to wring suspense out of a story that a great many people already knew exactly, not just the, you know, we were obviously a little young to have experienced experienced it firsthand, but, you know, our parents' generation or even people, you know, maybe 5 or 10 years older than you would have been watching it on TV live as it happened. And yet, again, just the way that he masterfully wrings suspense out of this, and that he does it without ever having to have the actors indicate to you how scared they are. Like, you get it, you know, and you don't have to have actors that are chewing scenery going, oh my God, what's going to happen? It's the worst thing in the world. They just, you know, the situation itself is so fraught, and it's, I mean, I do remember thinking as I was watching this, like, how, like, scripted it feels. And again, it's super accurate to what actually happened on the actual event. But there are all these little details that happen. You know, the fact that the general public had kind of lost interest in landing on the moon after Apollo 11 for the most part and kind of barely paid attention to Apollo 12. And by the time Apollo 13 rolled around, the networks wouldn't even play it. Like they're trying to do this, like, you know, thing where they're telling everybody.
Right. Well, why don't, you know, just for the sake of the listeners, why don't you just give a brief recap of what Apollo 13's mission was supposed to be and what and how the machine broke.
I mean, it kind of feels like everybody knows this. It's an Apollo mission. It was supposed to land on the moon. It was supposed to be the third manned mission on the moon. Stuff went wrong. It did not land on the moon. But these little details, so like that, you know, it's like, okay, nobody's paying attention to us. Okay, well, we need to have a disaster, and then everybody will pay attention to us. So an oxygen tank explodes due to some bad insulation on a piece of wiring is what they ultimately determined. And when that happens, they basically lose all power because the power comes from these fuel cells that are driven by hydrogen and oxygen. And so they can't stay in the command module, so they have to move over to the LEM. So a moon mission, the rocket, the big Saturn V, hurls these two things up into space. One of them is called the command module, and one of them is called the LEM, which is the lunar excursion module. And they both get shot towards the moon, and then get stuck in an orbit around the moon. And then one of them keeps orbiting around the moon, the command module keeps orbiting around the moon, while the LEM, which is the lander thing with the legs and the, you know, that you think of as the moon lander, that goes down to the surface. The astronauts do stuff on the surface, and that launches back up again, hooks back up with the command module, and they all go back to Earth. So the command module lost all power. It lost so much power that they were worried about, because the command module is also the thing that re-enters the atmosphere. At least the top little cone part of it does. And so without power and without any way for them to know which direction they were facing is the other thing that happened. This thing called gimbal lock, which I won't get into the details of, but they didn't know which direction they were facing. They did not know, you know, and so and they didn't know how far off course they were. They did not have power to the navigation computer. And so they had to do a lot of this stuff by hand, like literally by hand, like using slide rules and stuff to try to do these calculations. You see at one point Tom Hanks like scrawling down stuff in pencil and then asking NASA to check his math, and three different guys on the ground all check his math. And that's a thing that's just like you would punch that into your phone calculator and it would take 12 seconds. And then you would punch it in again and double check, and maybe one other person would check, or you'd put it in the computer and the computer would calculate it. But in this case, they had to do all of that stuff by hand, which is blows my mind. So I was going somewhere with some of this, but I don't remember where it is anymore. So
no, we were just talking about like what went wrong.
Yeah,
like specifically how it went wrong and how they went about fixing it.
Yeah.
So let's get into this. I know that not everything in Apollo 13 is factually true.
I mean,
what in the film is inaccurate?
There is only one thing that aside from two things. Number one is the quote. So in the in the original mission, and you can go and listen to this online. He says, "Houston, we've had a problem." And it, for some reason, that became "Houston, we have a problem" in sort of the vernacular. And for whatever reason, Ron Howard decided to go with the "Houston, we have a problem" instead of "Houston, we've had a problem," which is a silly sort of little thing, but it's also like one of the rare deviations from reality. And then the other thing that's, again, that they changed for reasons I don't entirely understand is, so there's a whole subplot, which again, feels like a thing that you would write into a movie, but actually happened, about Gary Sinise's character, who was originally, so it's originally supposed to be Bill Paxton, Tom Hanks, and Gary Sinise are the three members who were supposed to go on this thing. But what happened is for every mission, there's three people that go on the mission, and then there's three people that are backup crew, and the backup crew trains all together, and they're ready to go at a moment's notice if something happens to the prime crew. But one of the members of the backup crew got rubella, and in the movie, for some reason, they changed it to measles. And I guess maybe because measles, they were worried people wouldn't know what rubella was, or, you know, it was easier, I guess. So because he got measles, he had exposed Gary Sinise's character to it. He had exposed everybody to it, both the prime crew and the backup crew. So all six astronauts had been exposed to rubella. I mean, you can't have somebody getting sick, obviously, in the middle of space or on the moon.
Right. It would not be smart to wake up with chicken pox while you're in a lunar.
Yeah, which is ironic given what happens to Bill Paxton's character. But at any rate, because they were all exposed, normally they would just swap the prime crew for the backup crew, but they couldn't swap the prime crew for the backup crew. And all of the astronauts had had their vaccination and or had the disease And so they were all immune except for Gary Sinise's character. He had never been vaccinated. And so he couldn't go. And again, they changed that from rubella to measles, I guess, just because people are more familiar with measles. And
that is interesting. I didn't know that one at all. But is it, as far as you can tell, there's nothing in the space mission itself that was tweaked or shortened or lengthened or abbreviated?
No, I mean, like, very, you know, obviously it's a movie. And so it's sort of, they structured the, you know, what they decided to show and what they didn't decide to show. But there are so many things that even I forgot or did not know until doing some research on this time. You know, like, for instance, like I said, that TV broadcast that they tried to broadcast and that Tom Hanks's wife had to actually drive to NASA in order to be able to see it because none of the networks were showing it. This whole bit in the middle of the movie where, you know, so they had to go from the command module into the LEM. And so, you know, they had to have enough oxygen to breathe, but also in space, oxygen is not even necessarily the problem. The problem is you have to also get rid of the carbon dioxide that you're exhaling, or you will very quickly get carbon dioxide poisoning and you will die.
Which I believe we covered extensively in our Event Horizon episode. Did we?
Yeah. And so...
what carbon dioxide will do to you if you don't get rid of it.
So they had to get rid of this carbon dioxide, and so they have these filters that soak up the carbon dioxide and chemically, you know, remove it from the air. So there was a set of filters that were designed for the command module and a set of filters that were designed for the lunar module. And the ones for the lunar module were only designed to scrub enough carbon dioxide for two astronauts for 3 days.
Oh, okay. So basically what they're – like if we could put it in layman's terms, what they were trying to do is trying to put like – a home air conditioning filter and fit it a car filter and somehow fit it into a house filter like that.
Yeah, basically.
You know, Ron Howard is really good at telling the audience, look, they need to turn this into that.
Right.
He basically says that in the movie, but yeah. Now I get it. They were just trying to turn, you know, a hexagon filter into
Harris says at one point, he goes, we got to figure out how to fit a square peg into a round hole, which is literally exactly what they had to do.
But it's technically, it was kind of the same machine, just in a vastly different form.
Right. And so, you know, one of the interesting things that points out about sort of how the lunar missions worked, right, is it was very compartmentalized, right? Because you'd think, okay, well, why would you not design those two things so that they were the same size? But the people who built the LEM was an entirely different company and a different set of hundreds of people than the people who built the command module. And they obviously had to interface with one another and they had to work together. But they were built by entirely separate groups of people. And then,
and you know, built for different purposes.
Right. And there is – well, but either way, I mean, like the purpose of a carbon dioxide filter is to remove carbon dioxide.
I got you. Yeah.
So like theoretically, there's no reason why those two things should have been – different.
Right. So a smart engineer would come in and say, look, figure out a way to make the filters in A the same size as the filters in
exactly.
B.
Exactly. And that's right. Not at all an insurmountable sort of thing. And again, the only reason why they didn't have enough of the filters for the LEM was because the LEM, those filters, they brought just enough for two guys who are going to be on the moon for like 36 hours or 48 hours versus now they're all three of them in the LEM for 6 days. And so there just wasn't enough, you know, but those filters weren't designed to handle that amount of carbon dioxide scrubbing.
Carbon dioxide, right.
No, and there's even a moment in the movie where a couple of moments, actually, there's a character who's constantly, you know, Ed Harris is constantly asking him, like, well, can we do this? Can we do this in the lunar module? And he's like, well, it wasn't designed for that. They have to use the lunar module's rocket in order to change their trajectory, which was not designed for that. The rocket on the lunar module was designed to get them down to the moon and then lift them up off the moon. And the rocket on the command module was the one that did all the maneuvers that, you know, got them out of, you know, put them into moon orbit and got them out of the moon orbit and put them in the right orbit so that they would come in at the right angle on the atmosphere. And that engine was potentially damaged. They found out ultimately that it was damaged. If they had fired it probably would have exploded the whole ship. And so Ed Harris had to make a very difficult decision, like, do we try to fire that rocket or do we use the lunar module rocket, which for something it was completely not designed for? And he asks the guy who is the lead engineer on the lunar module, and can we do this? And he's like, I don't want any responsibility. It was not designed to do that. And he's like, I don't care about, like, just tell me, will it work for this or not? And he's like, I guess so. And again, it's because, like, they had these totally different sets of people. And one of the things that this movie really brought home to me and brings home to me again every time I watch it is the complete lunacy, no pun intended, of people that think the moon landing was faked. You realize how many people would have to be in on, like, every person who designed every one of those nozzles that, you know, that shoots off a little bit of gas and makes the spaceship rotate would have to be, you know, like all of these hundreds and hundreds of people just in mission control alone, let alone all of the people that built all the systems and the subsystems and programmed the computer and like all of the stuff that had to be done in order to go to the moon. Like it involved tens of thousands of people, and hard to keep a conspiracy quiet when you have tens of thousands of people in on it.
Interesting. Interesting.
In short, moon landing was not faked.
Okay, so you're watching the film as a young man who wants to become an astronaut and a movie nut. Were you prepared for the movie to take great licenses, or were you like, you better get it right? Like, would that have bothered you if it had been wildly off base?
I was young enough at that point that I, you know, I was 17 years old. I don't think I would have cared one way or another. I just wanted to see a good movie. And I didn't know enough of the details to be able to pick it apart necessarily when that first time I watched it anyway.
Because I think this is the heart of our show is, does accurate science hurt, hinder, or sometimes does it? And in the case of this movie, it won Oscars. It got huge box office. Everybody loves this movie.
Well, again, it helps that it felt like something, like just the event itself, you know, so they're going out to the moon. You know, this thing explodes. They have to figure out how to get these filters to work. Bill Paxton's character gets sick, which is a thing that actually happened because they couldn't drink enough water because they only had a very limited amount of water because their oxygen tanks had exploded, and that was how they made their water. You burn hydrogen and oxygen, you get water. So they had a very limited amount of water, and Bill Paxton actually got Fred Hayes got a urinary tract infection and had 104 degree fever. And the thing about the medical mutiny where they tear off their things that are monitoring them, that was a thing that actually happened. And the thing that I had not known about until doing some research for this viewing, because the one thing that always rang a little false to me when I was watching it was this idea, this very end. So they finally make it back home. There's a running thing the whole way through about whether or not they're going to hit the atmosphere at the right angle. And you know, they could burn up if they hit it at the wrong angle or skip back out into space. And because they weren't carrying moon rocks, which is also true to real life, they miscalculated how, you know, what that angle should be because they were expecting the craft to be heavier, and all their calculations had been built based around this idea that they were going to be having a couple hundred pounds of moon rocks on board, which was the point of the mission, was for them to go and gather specific types of moon rocks, was what the mission was supposed to be about. And so anyway, they're coming into this atmosphere and nobody, you know, they're not sure. The angle is kind of sort of barely within tolerances, and, you know, it could be very bad. They could very well burn up in the atmosphere. And so this is, you know, a real thing that happens in missions. You know, when you start entering the atmosphere, you have this heat shield, and you know that you've seen this in so many movies where like the fire starts moving past the windows because you're going so fast that just the friction with air sets the air on fire, more or less. This heat shield protects the cabin from that. But if you come in too fast, the heat gets too hot and it'll just explode. Or if the heat shield is damaged for some reason, which they also weren't sure about, if the explosion had damaged the heat shield. So there's this moment where they say, oh, it's going to take 3 minutes. And if it's any, you know, no craft has ever taken longer than 3 minutes. So there's a blackout. So, you know, while your ship is on fire, basically, you can't communicate. The radio waves can't get through. So there's a communications blackout. You can't get in touch with the command module. And so nobody knows whether they're made it or not at that point. And so this 3 minutes goes by. And in reality, that's another thing they changed for reasons I don't entirely understand, because in reality, it was about 4 minutes. It was how long they expected them to be in the communications blackout. But I always felt like, okay, well, this feels like a little bit of artistic license, because they would have been able to know how long they should be in blackout for, and they're probably just dragging this out. But in reality, what actually happened was they expected them to be in blackout for about 4 minutes, but because this angle, their reentry angle, was a little bit wonky, they ended up being in blackout for 6 minutes. And so for that period of time between 4 minutes and 6 minutes, they were like, no craft had ever taken 6 minutes to get through that reentry blackout.
Right. So that 2 minute window was probably them thinking the worst.
Yeah. By 5 minutes, they were like, okay, that's it. They must have burned up. Like there's no other possibility. And then, you know, and so like that, again, that moment is a thing that, you know, you would script in a movie as a moment of maximum tension at the climax of your movie. But it's 100% real. It actually happened.
What I love about it is that, you know, you would think about it from a screenwriting point of view. You'd think, well, gee, something based on fact, and not only fact, but highly documented and certifiable fact that you can dig up the exact data of what happened. That must make writing it a whole lot easier than writing just complete fiction that you won about a, you know, a space mission. On the other hand, being forced to whittle everything down and maintain the truth to a 2+ hour movie is just, it's an amazing skill. I have to throw out some love to the writers. It's William Broyles Jr. and Al Reinert, who adapted the book by Jim Lovell and Jeffrey Kluger.
Yeah.
So, I mean, we're writers. We have to give credit to, like, just being able to, the veracity and the truthfulness is impressive on its own. But being able to wedge it all into a 2-hour movie that doesn't feel like a documentary, this could have so easily felt like a Time Life documentary movie.
Yeah.
But thanks to the cast, there's real stakes. There's real humanity.
Well, and you know, and a lot of the directing choices, especially in 1994, whenever this came out, you know, famously Ron Howard decided to shoot all the zero gravity stuff in zero gravity, which was, you know, not an easy thing to do. And the studio went along with him and the actors went along with it. And, you know, they actually built a set inside this plane. It's called, you know, nicknamed the Vomit Comet, that does these parabolic arcs. And so for a period of, like, I think it's 5 minutes at a time, you're weightless. And so they had these 5-minute chunks in which to shoot any of this footage that, you know, where it had to actually be weightless. And so, like, you know, unlike, 2001, where they did, you know, like the floating pen by sticking it to a piece of glass and moving it around. Like, you know, there's a scene of similar thing where it's just a tape recorder floating in the cabin and it's actually just floating. And, you know, nowadays they'd probably do it with CGI and it wouldn't look as good, you know, because there's a lot of subtle things that happened in weightlessness that you don't. I've never seen weightlessness, even in something like Gravity, which is, you know, another movie that gets a whole lot of scientific stuff right. The weightless stuff never quite feels right.
No, you're right. It's an overall atmospherical thing. It's not just does that pen, is the pen floating in air? It's also the way light bounces off it. It's also the way it its own weight plays off itself as it spins. It's hard to describe. It's like the difference between, like, hey, you might have just created a really impressive digital monster, but, and I mean, unless you're like top of the line animator, it's not going to look the same as just latex. It's just not.
Yeah, but even beyond that, I'm talking about even just more subtle stuff. Like, you know, when you're in space, your face gets a little bit puffy because there's, you know, your body is designed so that your feet are down and your body is kind of designed so that fluid gets pumped back up by the pumping action of your heart. And so, like, your face kind of gets filled with fluid, or like the way that you know, when you sit, like however you're sitting right now, your hands are probably sitting on your lap or down by your sides or something like that. And that's because gravity is pulling them down. And so that's the most comfortable and most sort of obvious place to have them. But when you're in weightless, there's no gravity pulling them down. And so your hands might kind of just start floating around a little bit without you even necessarily realizing that that's what's going on. And, you know, and just little things like that about how you would move differently in weightlessness. And when you push yourself up against your seat, you actually would start pushing, you know, you'd start floating away from your seat instead of now if I try to sit up straight, you know. And so just little things like that read so real in this movie that no other movie, no matter however big the budget, has ever really gotten right, because they aren't actually filming in a weightless environment.
Have you ever gone weightless?
I have not. I have. That's, you know, one of my dreams. I think maybe one of these days I might.
Oh, dude, we're gonna do it. There are retail places
ticket.
We can do it.
Yeah,
now.
No, I know. And I mean, I guarantee you, I would puke. I have serious inner ear issues. I can't go on roller coasters. But it'd be
worth it for 5 minutes. Well, I'm gonna let you wrap it up because I know this is one of your favorite space movies. But I love Apollo 13. It was a lot of fun to revisit. I think that the movie will hold up for years and continue to find new fans because it is both like Hollywood movie entertaining, but then once you realize how factual it is, that makes it even more impressive.
Yeah. I mean, it's completely timeless. There's not a single effect that doesn't work even 25 years later. There's not a single choice in this movie that makes it feel dated, you know, to when the movie was made. It is truly a timeless classic of a movie. It is an A+ on scientific accuracy. It is an A+ on entertainment value. I think that might be our first, certainly my first double A+.
Well, we haven't gotten to our second movie yet. All right. I mean, like, let's not ruin it. I mean, I know.
There's a segue.
You, as the man who wrote and directed a found footage film, and someone who has studied the moon, and astrophysics and outer space extensively. I cannot imagine that you, Stephen, would not be a huge fan of Apollo 18.
So I'm going to start off. I just want to go on record saying I wanted to do this movie first because I wanted to end on a high note. But Scott felt it made more sense to go chronologically, which is hard to argue with.
I thought we would spend 88% of the episode talking about that, and then like this as kind of an afterthought. And then
except I have three pages of notes on this because it has so much bad science in it.
Okay, all right. Well, for those who don't remember, and which is mostly everyone except the most hardcore of hardcore horror fans. Apollo 18 was a 2011 horror sci-fi found footage
sort of
period piece produced by Timur Bekmambetov, who's done some good genre stuff and some not great genre stuff, distributed by Dimension. It is a relatively cheap, what looks like a cash-in as like a we want to make one too on the heels of Cloverfield and Paranormal Activity. And it's a great idea in concept,
yep.
A found footage horror film about a forgotten and secret space mission, moon mission, and we find out why nobody ever found out the footage and da-da-da-da.
Yeah.
There's lots of great ways, lots of really interesting directions you could go in with this. And what bugs me about this movie so much is that it has so many ingredients that I personally love. Given that it takes place, obviously, in the Apollo program, it's a period piece. It's a horror film that takes place in outer space, and it is found footage.
And it's monsters. You love monsters.
And monsters. And
it's a creature feature, basically.
Yeah. If there is ever a 73-minute forgotten genre film that I should be championing and tweeting about once a year and reminding people that it's fun, it's this. And man, I've tried. This
fun.
Is now the third time since it's been released that I've seen this movie. Third time. And it just refuses to take. I'm never going to. Obviously, I'm done. I don't hate it quite as much as you. I do think some components of it work. But I'm going to let you roll and give out the plot synopsis.
All right. So it's an alternate history movie, which again, it's just a thing that I should totally love. Like, you're right. It has all the elements of things that I should like as well. And part of the reason why I dislike this movie as much as I do is that even in this rewatch, I was like, you know, the first 10 or 15 minutes, they get so much stuff right. And then it just, oof. But no, it is about, so in reality, in our real world, we got up through Apollo 17. Apollo 17 was the last manned mission to the moon to date. And there was Apollo 18 scheduled. It got scrapped due to budgetary, like, you know, by that point, you know, Apollo 13 kind of revived some interest in it, but then 14, 15, 16, 17 went. And by that point, people were like, all right, well, what's the point? We've been to the moon. We got enough moon rocks. They actually say that in this movie. We got enough moon rocks. We don't really need, you know, the general public said that. And one of the issues I have with this movie is that they put those words into the mouth of an astronaut. Like, oh, well, we got enough moon rocks. What do we need to go back to the moon for? No astronaut, especially not one who'd been training his entire life to go land on the moon.
That's a good point. It would be like having your pilot hero in your movie be like, who needs to fly?
Yeah.
Right? Like flying is silly, said the pilot. Like,
So in reality, Apollo 18 never happened. And in this movie posits that there was a secret mission of Apollo 18 to the moon.
Oh, what a great pitch. I can see, because I pitch stuff to you all the time. I'll call Steven 11:30 at night and be like, horror movie around, blah, 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 blah. And he goes, oh, I like it. All right, no, we've done that. And this is a great, hey, Steven, what was the last Apollo mission? 17. I got it. What about a found footage Apollo? And he'd go, hey, that's not a bad idea. That's an interesting.
Great idea. That's a brilliant idea.
All right. So sorry, keep going.
So the idea is that this is a super secret Apollo mission under the Department of Defense. Now, I've already pointed out one of the reasons why that's doesn't work, because any Apollo mission, any moon landing mission is going to involve hundreds and hundreds of people. So there was no secret Apollo mission. It just isn't.
That's always my favorite part about any conspiracy theory is like, obviously I'm open-minded and intelligent enough to believe that there are conspiracies out there that we don't know anything about.
Right.
But the more people you involve, the less I believe it.
Yep.
Because if there's a conspiracy involving me, you, and four people, maybe.
Yep.
But if there's a conspiracy involving me, you, and 400 people,
yep.
No, never happened.
Yep, exactly. And so, like, it's simply not feasible. But it's one of those things where you're like, okay, that's the premise of the movie. I can suspend my disbelief on that. It brings up some other questions, such as why are they filming this if it's a super secret mission? Like, because, you know, one of the things that the movie gets right unequivocally in my book is the footage. I think the footage does an amazing job of recreating the look and the feel, right down to the sound in a lot of cases. Although the more the movie goes on, the less fidelity there is to that particular thing. But the look of the footage has this perfect graininess.
I'm glad that we're being able to throw out little breadcrumbs of compliments, because I didn't even think of that. And it is, if you're, you know, I think the script and the editing is just not great. But in service of a better film, you're right. The visual approach is accurate.
It gets going very, very quickly, which is good. It doesn't waste a whole lot of time, which is, you know, funny. Again, that's in contrast to Apollo 13, which takes until minute 50 for the spacecraft to explode, which I don't think you'd be able to get away with in a movie that came out in 2020, that you could spend 50 minutes before you get to what's essentially the inciting incident of the story. But it 100% works in Apollo 13. Here, they just, you know, they get them. There's a couple of interviews on the ground, and then boom, they're launched into space, and good for them. The cast is, you know, is they're fine, I guess.
It's mostly two guys, and they're both fine. Yeah. They're both good.
The three guys.
Decent performer.
One of the things about this movie that works in the context of the movie, normally, you know, one of my pet peeves with found footage movies is that, like most movies, everybody in it is beautiful, because that's just how movies are, right? There's a certain, you know, look to actors, and so these are three dark, square jaw, straight out of central casting, you know, leading man type actors. But that archetype also kind of happens to fit astronauts. And so, like, you know, from a look perspective, you kind of buy them as astronauts right off the bat, because they look like the kind of guys who would have been astronauts in the 60s. You look at pictures of Buzz Aldrin and Jim Lovell was a little funny looking, but Neil Armstrong or whatever, you know, they're test pilots. They're manly men. They're the people you think of when you think of sort of leading man types. And so that works in this movie, and that's pretty much it. that's all the good stuff I got. Because then they launch to the moon, and I'm going to get into one of my pet peeves with found footage in general, that this movie just, that it's worse in this movie because of the nature of the movie, which is the constant cutting. One of the things that works, that's great about found footage movies, is that you're trying to posit this as sort of a real thing. And one of the ways that you do that is you have space, no pun intended. You have space in your scenes. You shoot things from, you know, you shoot things from a single camera. And that makes it feel like, you know, what we all think of as surveillance cameras or whatever. In this thing, they want you to believe that on this super secret mission, they had like three surveillance cameras inside the lunar module. And they each brought a camera with them, and each had a body camera on them. And like, so they have like 15 cameras that they're covering this super secret mission with, and they cut between them every 3.5 seconds for 73 minutes.
Yeah. See, for a found footage movie, it also, the more editing there is, it also starts nagging at your brain like a little scab. Who's cutting all this?
Yep.
Exactly. Like, I mean, like, if you have longer cuts, your brain doesn't keep asking that, because it feels like you're buying into the artifice of the story, which is, all right, somebody obviously found this footage and cut it together. Not professional filmmakers, but this was what, 8 12-minute reels, and they cut those 12-minute reels together. Got it.
Well, in this one, they kind of started off as if it were like actually a documentary, which is a valid style of found footage. It's not one that I super love, but like, it's like, you know, there's music. It's clearly cut like a documentary. You got these talking head interviews interspersed with B-roll, and so it feels like, you know, it's just a documentary about a moon landing.
To me, a lot of times it just feels like almost not filler, but maybe that the connective story in an anthology, which is here's 12 minutes of this setting up the real story.
Well, and so the one of the things, again, one of the things they get right is this, the graininess of the footage, that it looks like actual film footage from the time. But that adds an extra layer, you know, spoiler alert, it's a found footage movie. Everybody dies by the end of it. And, you know, the last shot of the movie is the astronaut has launched off the surface of the moon, headed back towards the command module. And we see his camera that he, for some reason, has set up filming himself inside this Russian space lander, which you know, talk about the story in a second. But how did they get that footage back? It's a freaking film camera in a spaceship that crashed back onto the moon from hundreds of miles up. It's toast. That footage is toast. Even if you sent somebody to collect it, which why would you? That footage is toast. And so like all of the footage that they shot on the moon, with the exception of stuff that they were beaming back live, is gone. But so let's talk about the plot then, I guess. Because
yeah, let's talk about everything between the first 10 minutes and the last 10 minutes.
The plot of this movie, you know, what happens is they land on the moon. And when they land on the moon, they discover that there's a Russian moon lander that is there and has been abandoned or the people inside it have been killed. And so, I mean, that's a neat idea. Like, oh, what if the Apollo 18 landed on the moon and there was a, you know, where they discovered that the Russians had landed before we did. And so they have to figure out what happened to these Russian astronauts. And what happened to these Russian astronauts is that moon rocks are actually alive. They're little creatures that live in
some though. Rocks. Some are, not all.
So, right.
I think the implication is that like these creatures have, you know, learned to take on camouflage as if they were, you know, like our, what's the stupid, chameleon.
Which begs the question, right? Because so why does a chameleon disguise itself?
To hide from being eaten.
Yeah. Something eating these moon rocks?
Well, I mean, you know.
I mean, maybe that's an Apollo 19 question. Like, they'll answer it.
You know, before we get to the makeup of the monsters, this is one of the biggest problems that I have with a lot of found footage and indie horror movies in general. I think a lot of people can tell when you're doing filler scenes. And, you know, like you and I, when we were putting together the final cut of Found Footage 3D, we had, in my opinion, five funny, interesting characters. And it was, can we find the best stuff of them? In this, these are like three uninteresting characters. And
they're,
like,
they're completely nobodies. Yeah.
And they're just yammering at each other and talking into. So after 10 or 15 minutes of that, you realize, well, it's not really advancing the plot and it's not really advancing the characters. So what you're doing is you're just spinning the movie's wheels until you get to some scary stuff later. Yep. And man, that is boring. Yeah. That is boring.
No, and for all of the quick cut of this thing, like it had an opportunity to be a super creepy movie, right? It had an opportunity to like have, you know, to build some atmosphere, build a couple characters that you care about, set them in this creepy environment, give it some space instead of having to cut every 3 seconds and feel like, all right, let's get next scene. And then they realize, oh, crap, we've gone through everything so quickly that we don't actually have
What if we were talking about this, about like it turned out to be, hey, there's only like five cuts in this movie and it works. You know, like why? I guess the quicker you cut it, the more it seems like an action movie, I guess.
Yeah, the most egregious one for me, there's a moment about two-thirds of the way through where they have discovered that these moon rocks are alive, I think, by this point. They are, they discovered that these other astronauts are dead. Like, I think they've lost communication with NASA. Like, they're in bad shape. And what do? They go back to the lander, they take off their spacesuits, and they just kind of chill for a while. And like nothing happens. And it's like, and they seem like completely not particularly bothered by the fact that all of this stuff is happening. And not in the good way, you know, that I was talking about earlier. Because they get that 100% wrong. Like from the beginning, like there's a sequence where they're landing on the moon, which I think maybe was meant to be some sort of callback to the actual Apollo 11 moon landing where, they got to the point Neil Armstrong saw where they were supposed to be landing and realized there was a couple of big boulders there and then he wasn't going to be able to land there. And so he had to fly the LEM on a little bit further and that put them right to the edge of where they would have enough fuel to launch back off and meet back up with the spaceship. And they were like literally seconds away from aborting when he found a place to land and landed the lander. So they kind of are trying to do that here, but they build this moment of just completely fake and uninteresting quote tension where he's like, oh, we can't land there. Oh God, we have to like keep going. And they seem so like they start panicking. They start like freaking out. And I'm just like, why? Like when space rocks become little space monsters, okay, if that's time, maybe an astronaut could freak out. Like by that point, maybe, I could buy an astronaut freaking out, but oh no, our landing site's a little cluttered. We have to move to a different one. Like that's a thing they would have trained for 5,000 times. they seem completely unprepared for it and unready for it. Like, oh no, what are we going to do? What are we going to do? Oh my God, I can't believe it. And then he manages to find some way to do it. And I think they damage the craft on their way. I don't know. It's just,
I think that while I do respect the effort to like kind of make it look like a period, like a product of its time, and having the creatures or the threat be something potentially unseen or subtle is a smart thought. But in the grand scheme of things, when you're talking about the movie, you got to realize that people are just going to go, what? It's monster little rocks? That's your threat? That they're just like little rocks with that some of them crawl around with legs?
Well, so they also have an opportunity in this movie. Because, you know, as far as like two-thirds into the movie, it's an open question among the astronauts themselves whether or not like they're hallucinating or whether these things that appear to be happening to them are real or not. But they've already shown the audience that they're real. And so like, again, if it would have felt like it would have been interesting to have them, to have us as the audience not know, okay, are these guys experiencing some sort of weird-ass space madness, or are these rocks actually coming alive? And, like, you know, having that drive the second act.
I think you mean space dementia.
Space dementia, right. But they don't.
You know what it is? It feels like, because, again, the movie is all of 75 minutes long. It really feels to me like, this feels like you would trim it down to, like, 20 minutes, and that would be your opening for a better movie. That is not found footage anymore.
Right. Or you do the opposite and you draw out these moments of tension and you draw out the paranoia and you draw out the idea of like, because again, this should be terrifying, right? You're stuck on, like that alone, you're stuck on the moon.
So what you're saying, Stephen, is that if we could somehow get all of the footage from Apollo 18 and were allowed to make your cut, you could make it into a scary film?
No, I couldn't, because those characters are completely and utterly uninteresting. And you have to have characters that you care about first. And
you know, on the Blu-ray, there are four, maybe five alternate endings?
Okay, 75 minutes of this movie was way more than enough for me. I have no interest in watching.
I'm just saying, like, this more is, of it. Because it also speaks to, like, how the film, I mean, the middle section of this movie is completely cut at random. There's no kind of narrative arc to follow. It's all choppy and scattershot. And they shot five different endings. I mean, so I'm betting that this movie at one point, they probably had, maybe they had a director's cut that was 140 minutes. It seems like they just,
who knows?
Just shot and shot and shot and shot and said, all right, here's enough for a feature length movie here.
Who knows? I mean, clearly, yes, the problems start with the script in this movie. And again, there's just no saving those characters because they're complete, like they do nothing that makes you interested in them, let alone care about them. That's just nothing at any point. They are complete and total just rocks. They're moon rocks, basically.
I got it. So, the movie.
Let's talk about some of the crappy science in this movie. I think we've talked enough about the crappy filmmaking.
Good.
Go. All right. So this is not really a science thing. I mean, you know, I don't even know if this counts as a science thing or just a how are you this dumb kind of thing. There's a moment where he picks up a moon rock. He's out on the surface of the moon. He's not in the lander. He's on the surface of the moon, which means he's wearing a what, Scott?
Spacesuit.
And that spacesuit has what covering his hands?
Gloves.
He picks up a moon rock and he goes, this sample feels strange. And he's holding a rock in his gloved hand. What? It doesn't feel like anything. It feels like the inside of your glove is what it feels like.
I'm not trying to, you know, be armchair screenwriter, but the easier way to fix that would be this feels heavier than this feels light. Not this feels strange.
Yeah. The way he's holding it too, it looks like he's feeling the surface of it. And it's like, he's not. He's wearing like really thick gloves that are pressurized. Those things are notorious for being like terrible for trying to feel like to even maneuver in very well. Minor thing, they sleep inside the LEM. That's a real thing that happened. And the little hammock thing that they stretch out kind of was a real thing. In Apollo 11, they slept or they laid down on the floor of the LEM. But in the later ones where they were actually going to be on the surface for multiple days, they actually had to find a way to sleep. And so they slung these hammocks across the LEM that they could sleep in. So that was real. He puts in earplugs though, which I don't think would have ever been allowed. You need to be able to be woken up at a you know, fraction of a second at a moment's notice. You're on the moon. You're in the most dangerous, inhospitable environment a man has ever been to. You don't get to have a, you know, a good night's sleep where you like just, you know, shut out external noises. Cause if an alarm goes off and it doesn't wake you up, you're dead. So, again, little thing, but it's just like, it's just emblematic of like one of the things that just bothers me about this movie. They are terrified at every little thing, which, as we have said, is not a thing that astronauts and you know, again, by the time you get to living moon rocks, okay, fine. But they're like, you know, early on in the movie, they're scared of just like the tiniest little thing. Like they see footprints that aren't theirs, which is interesting. I would imagine that an astronaut's first reaction to that would be, whoa, okay, why are there footprints here that aren't ours? Which brings up another point, which is the fact that they didn't tell these astronauts why they were going is ludicrous. It's only there because they wanted the audience to discover it and along with the astronauts. You wouldn't build this entire super secret mission and you're sending tens of billions of dollars to the moon and then just like leave the astronauts in the dark as to what it is that they're doing there. Like, you trusting them. They established early on in the movie that they're not allowed to tell their families that they're going to the moon. They've established this cover story that they're actually going off, you know, someplace else. And so they're trusting these astronauts, obviously, to be discreet about what's happening here. The fact that they're going on a moon mission is a thing that they are not allowed to tell even their own wives. And yet they keep a secret from them as to what it is that they're doing up there or why, you know, that the Russians had landed and we need you to go check out their spacecraft. Like, that's a thing that you would tell the astronauts because they need to know.
Right. And plus, like, there's also one of those things that filmmakers have to learn. And whether we did it on our movie or not is up to other people to decide. But yeah. When you're playing the found footage game, hyper-cutting and cutting mid-sentence and like static and visual noise and all that stuff starts to grate on a human being's eyes and ears.
Yeah.
It really does.
It's just an assault on the senses
yeah.
in a bad way.
And that's another reason that why long cuts can also be a respite from those kind of, you know, sometimes you have to have that digital or visual noise to sell what you're selling. But you also are trying to make a real movie that is, even if it's supposed to be scary, visually and orally pleasing to, you know, or interesting. And this just, it cuts between, you just can feel the movie going, we're getting to some scary stuff later, but here's 10 minutes of a roughage that you have to get through. Have to.
So I think what it comes down to is that the movie doesn't trust its audience. It doesn't trust the audience to be like scared when they need to be scared. It keeps having to telegraph to them, oh, you need to be scared, you know, either through the actor's performances or the way that they're cutting or music or whatever else. And one of the most emblematic things to me, they've discovered this other lunar lander, this Russian lunar lander. And they go inside and it's covered in blood. Like the inside of it is, there's just blood everywhere, like all over the place. And that's all you need to know. That in and of itself is a creepy image. It's visual storytelling. We know something bad happened in here. We can tell that it's blood. We can tell that like that's all you need. And yet over the top of while they're showing this shot, they have one of the astronauts go, and I quote, this is an exact quote from the movie. There's blood. A lot of it. Someone got hurt bad.
Yep.
Like, yes, we know that. We see the blood. Why are you treating me like a complete and utter idiot?
I think a lot of times producer and studio notes, and even if you do a movie like this where you probably didn't get a lot of notes from audiences or studios, the default is underline everything. Underline everything. If you show a sign that says radioactive, don't enter here, you also have to have a character say, hey, that's radioactive, don't go in there.
No, like, which is, it's just, yeah, it's so, it's ludicrous. All right, so some more science things.
Yep.
They go to this crater, and they have a sequence that should be kind of creepy, but is not at all, where he goes down into the crater.
That is a huge misstep, and it should be a great sequence.
All right, so a couple of problems with that from a scientific point of view. Number one is they would totally be able to see inside the crater. Like, that's not, like, of course they can see inside the crater. Like, there's still light there, like, just because the sun is not shining directly on it. The sun is shining on the moon. Have you ever been outside at night, Scott?
I have.
Have you been outside at night, like in a dark place, but there was a full moon? Could you see things?
At least, say yeah.
And you're 500,000.
I mean, I'm not, we're not in a court of law, but yes.
And at that point, you were 500,000 miles away from the moon. So imagine if you're actually standing on the surface of the moon.
Right.
The moon is still reflecting the sunlight. And so, like, there's no places that are so dark that you can't see inside them. But, that, you know,
right.
But I could live with that, I suppose, in this thing, you know, in the movie, if the sequence was good. But they, you know, they do try to do this thing where like, oh, he's got to snap pictures, and the flash, when the flash goes off, is the only time we can actually see anything. And again, the sequence is just it's a complete, there's no tension in it whatsoever. You know exactly what's going to happen. And,
right.
And
plus the flash, you can only see the flash thing. Dude, if you're going to copy Silence of the Lambs, you better come better than that.
Yeah, no.
Because that's the movie that is not, maybe not the first, but that's the movie that like that cemented the, you can only see what the audience sees when the flash goes on. That you don't need it either.
No.
If you're putting what they say, a hat on top of a hat. You don't exactly. need it.
Like how much cooler would that sequence have been if like, you know, if it had been a little bit more realistic where like you can see a little bit, but you really can't make out very much. And he has to like really get close to it or whatever. Right.
Right. There's something at the bottom of this crater and it's kind of the same color as the texture of the ground, but it's moving. You can definitely see it. And
especially with like the grainy footage that they have and, you know, you can play with the way the fact that the footage, you know, that
is picturing it like the old Bigfoot footage like that.
Yeah. Like that kind of thing where like, you know, am I seeing something? Am I not seeing something? Like it could have been a cool sort of creepy thing. He says at one point, like, so the guy goes, all right, I'm going to go down into the crater. And the other astronaut goes, the suits aren't ready for that kind of cold. And I think I literally slapped my head at that point. The suits were built to be in freaking space. Like, that is exactly what they were built for. They are exactly ready for that kind of cold because it's why they exist in the freaking first place. It's so ludicrous. If that were true, then every time you stood inside a shadow on the moon, your suit would, like, kill you.
Literally freeze up and break apart.
Yeah, I mean, like, that's what the suit is for. When you're on the moon, if there's no atmosphere, so there's nothing regulating the temperature around you. So when you are standing in the sun, you are standing in direct sunlight, and you're a couple hundred degrees. And if you move into the shade, you are essentially in space. And there's no sunlight shining on you. You are in minus a couple hundred degrees. And so the suits are built to handle exactly those kinds of temperature extremes. That's what the whole point of this suit is.
So why does the movie have to have him say that?
If they had gone somewhere with it, then I could have forgiven it. It could have been like, okay, again, in this movie, I can go with it. But then they don't even do anything with it.
They had subpar spacesuits. Fine.
Yeah. But they don't do any. Like, okay, well then, you know, that should be a Chekhov's gun at least. That should be something where you're setting something up where later on the suit freezes because he stays in the dark too long. Like, but no, he comes out and he's like, oh, it feels a little cold down there, but and then he's totally fine. It doesn't actually like, I think,
that's another thing that it really does the movie, to borrow an ugly old phrase, but the movie gives you, there's a lot of blue balls sequences.
Yeah.
And I, you know, a lot of horror movies do this where it's like, search around the hallway, search around the hallway. What is this? Cut to next morning.
Yeah.
You know, oh, like now we're in the wine cellar. What's that over there? What's that? Cut to the guy in a bathtub. And, you know, we were explained later, we'll get to what happened. And it's just so many cutaways and it's, the tension and the suspense is sucked out of it.
So that brings me to another question about these little moon rock things, right? Because I already established, like, why are they pretending to be moon rocks in the first place? Because, you know, what? And again, whatever. It's a science fiction movie. You can maybe go with that.
Let's say they're posing to be moon rocks because they know they'll be taken back home.
Okay.
One of the only things I really like about this movie is it kind of has this darkly ironic EC Comics ending where it says, half the space rocks, the moon rocks that were brought home and given out to as gifts to around the world,
have never been
relocated or they're missing.
Yeah, which is true.
And it's like, okay, I get it. You like the whole idea is some of these space rocks might be the aliens. That's fun.
Yeah, but like
I kind of like that.
But what is the like? Okay, so the mythology of these aliens makes no sense to me. Like, are they intelligent or are they not intelligent? Are they things that like? You know, because basically they spend the first half of the movie just messing with these guys, right? They don't like just like if their purpose was to kill them, which is what they ultimately do. They ultimately kill both of the astronauts so that they can't be taken off of the moon and brought back to Earth. So okay, well, if that was their plan, it was a shitty plan, or they did a shitty job of it because they didn't actually
right.
Get
are
back
they
to Earth.
Are they malevolent right. or are they sentient? Are they just hungry? What is it?
If they're sentient. Then why were they dumb enough to get themselves to attack the guy at the last minute of the movie so that the spaceship crashes instead of actually getting carried back to the thing and then taken back to Earth? If they're not sentient, then why do they spend the first half of the movie pretending to be hiding as moon rocks, and then and only showing themselves when the movie needs them to, because the movie's trying to do some sort of jump scare.
I honestly think that the writer Brian Miller probably had this nugget of a good idea, which is, what if some of those moon rocks they brought home had like aliens in them or a microbe or something? And that is a really interesting nugget
Every idea in this movie is an awesome idea. This movie should be amazing. And it's just like, you said, it's a great concept from beginning to end. What if the Russians got there first? What if the moon rocks were actually alive? Like, these are all brilliant. And I could see the pitch meeting for this and people being excited, like, holy crap, this is going to be amazing. And then just,
and then somebody said, all right, but we're going to, and then, wait, but then somebody said, but we're going to do it in found footage. And everybody went, oh.
No, even that, at that point in time, in 2012 or whatever, 2011, this came out.
Yeah.
That was when you wanted to do this. If somebody said it now, people would be like, oh God. But in 2011, that was right at the height of like, okay, well, we need to do every kind of movie as found footage at some point. Every kind of horror movie.
Yeah, and it had so many jump scares, which, you know, I don't hate jump scares, except when you lean on them way too much and this movie does.
When they're not effective, when you know that they're coming and they come and then you're like, okay, why? Like a jump scare at least has to make you jump. If it fails to make you jump, then, like, doing an effective jump scare is not as easy as a lot of people think that it is. But it has to work, and none of them work, because none of them have the elements.
Right, and again, when you don't have the characters that are interesting and you don't have the story that keeps the suspense percolating to make it scary, you go, boo! And that's there's your scare. Boo!
So, one other semi-scientific thing, you know, they have a place where they're supposed to be landing. And then they land on the moon. First of all, they have this moment right where they, okay, maybe we can't land where we were intending to land, and they land someplace else. The Apollo 11 mission ended up being about 4 miles away. They landed 4 miles away from where they originally intended to land, which doesn't sound like all of that much in the grand scheme of things. Obviously, when you're, you know, hurling a thing from the Earth to the moon and you land within 4 miles, that's great. It's incredibly impressive accuracy. It is not accurate enough that if you were landing to look for a specific thing, such as a Russian moon lander, that if you landed 4 miles off course, that you would ever accidentally run into that moon lander. You just wouldn't. Like, they didn't go 4 miles away from the lunar landers. And so,
I'm sorry. I'm just, like, thinking of moon rock pitches in my head right now. Interior NASA museum, broken glass all over the floor, security guard and a curator are standing there and goes, what was in this display? Moon rocks. Smash to credits.
Yeah. Most of those moon rocks, by the way, that they're talking about that are lost or they came back, they're not like rocks. They're like tiny little pebbles. They're like grains or maybe at most pebbles. They're not, they're not the big rocks that turn into these creatures.
Do you have one?
No, but my point is that they're not going to turn into these kinds of creatures.
I always another question would be, if you really did want to like dig into every little niche of this movie, why did the rocks wait until this mission to make their presence known?
Well, exactly. Like maybe it's because they happen to land near where the rocks are. Okay, I can buy that one. So there are a couple of other things. I just want to get through these science things because they bother me and I need to get it out.
Go. This show should be catharsis.
For all of their freaking out about little things like, oh my God, there's footprints from somebody else on the moon. What are we going to do? And scary music plays and he acts like he's the worst thing that could have ever possibly happened to them. There's long stretches of the movie where they cannot communicate via radio with either the command module in orbit around the moon or NASA back on Earth. They are completely cut off from any sort of communication, and they seem totally unbothered by this fact, which, like, you cannot relink to the command module unless you are in contact with the command module. You cannot get back to Earth unless you are in contact with Earth. Like, that is the most important thing that could possibly take up their time and attention would be, we need to reestablish communication or figure out what's going wrong, because if we can't communicate with the Earth, we are stuck here on the moon and we will die. There's a line, a kind of almost a throwaway line, where they talk about how they sent them there because they saw the Russian launch and they said, oh, the Russians launched. And so we decided to send our thing there. And it's like 2 or 3 days later that they land on the moon after the Russians. It takes months to prepare a normal moon launch, let alone a super secret one. And the idea that they saw the Russians launch, and it took 3 days to get to the moon. So within like a day or two, they decided, oh no, we got to get there to figure out what the Russians are doing. Let's launch an entire Apollo mission in the next 3 days in order to get these astronauts up on the moon. When their lander gets destroyed, one of the astronauts get contact, you know, this is one of the moments where they're in contact with Houston, and he said, you know, says something about a rescue mission. There's no rescue mission on the moon. I mean, maybe in this world where you can plan a moon launch, you know, with a day, you know, a day's notice, maybe they could send somebody to save them. But like the astronauts all knew if something went wrong while they were on the moon, you can't rescue somebody off the moon, especially if you have to risk killing the people that you have now sent to rescue the people off of the moon.
Yeah, there's that bit towards the end where he's talking to NASA and they're like, we've done all the analysis here and we're not going to be able to launch a rescue mission. And no, he starts railing and yelling and crying. And I'm like, all right. Even if you're trained, I could see you going, right. I don't want to die. I don't want to. But like he loses it in like a very childish way.
There's a point. There are several points in the movie where they hear the moon rocks making sounds. I don't feel like I even need to explain to everybody like why that's ridiculous. But they're in the lunar lander and the rocks are outside on the surface of the moon and they can hear them making these creepy sounds. Okay, sure, whatever. There's no atmosphere on the moon.
Right, like you and I, like as if we were sleeping in a cabin and I heard something outside and you'd go, it's probably a frog, dude. Like, we're on
Scott,
the moon.
Answer me this question. In space, can anyone hear you scream?
Nobody can hear anybody scream. And you couldn't hear sentient rocks rustling through the dust that covers the moon.
There's a moment. So speaking of sentient rocks, they get back into the LEM. They're counting down. They're about to launch the LEM, their own LEM, the two astronauts. And the rocks choose that moment, like right when they're about to launch, to suddenly like do something. And I don't remember what it was. But the rocks knew that they were about to try to launch and stop them.
At that point, the rocks could have said, guys, they're leaving. Get them now. And it wouldn't be more ridiculous.
Especially, again, if their plan is to get to Earth, that's what you've wanted this whole time. And if it's not, then why didn't you kill them sooner? It's just one screenwriter convenience after another.
I really was hoping that the movie was going to go, all right, by this point, you're still with us? Fine. Here's a big, giant monster, and it swallows the LEM, and the camera is still filming as it goes down its throat, because it's a big, giant monster. Yeah. And there, we sent you out with a big kaiju. Enjoy. Yeah. Ending I would have appreciated more than just, it's real. It really happened.
There's a sequence where he's inside the spacesuit, and I think he runs out of oxygen. I don't remember what happens exactly. Like if there's a hole in his suit or something. I don't even remember. I just wrote in my thing that there's no oxygen inside his suit and he's sitting there gasping for breath. Okay. If there's no air inside his suit at all, A, you wouldn't be able to hear anything because there's no air inside his suit and sound requires air to move. B, if there's no air inside his suit, and it wasn't like, he's run out of oxygen, but he's breathing his carbon dioxide. There was literally no gas of any sort inside of his suit, you're not going to be gasping for breath because there's literally nothing to gasp for.
Right.
Like you're just going to pass out in 15
literally
seconds.
Literally asphyxiation.
Right. You're just, you know, if you had air in your lungs would explode. And so the only way to survive in space when you're depressurized is you have to expel all stuff out of your lungs and then hope that you get to a place where you can breathe again within 15 seconds
right.
and pass out.
Right. And you've told our listeners that in the past.
Yes.
That if you happen to be in outer space and you're about to be in the void, going to be tossed out of an airlock, blow all the air out of your lungs as possible. Yep.
So there's still life support going on inside the Russian lander, despite the fact that they died and it was open to the oxygen. I don't entirely believe that.
Well, you don't know what kind of car battery's in there, man.
Yeah. So my last thing is not a scientific thing, but I think I want to end with bad filmmaking instead of bad sciences, which is the thing that we make fun of in found footage 3D, I think rightly so, and that this movie suffers from in spades, which is the a found footage movie does not work if you can't explain why once the shit hits the fan, they keep filming and keep filming and keep filming. And in this movie, they do. Like, it's not even that they have like body cameras on or whatever. They keep filming despite the fact that they're being like running away from sentient moon rocks. And they're like, hold on, let me keep, I got to make sure that I keep my camera on. Like they don't even bother to be like, oh, we need to document everything. Because of course, by the end of the movie, all the footage is destroyed anyway. So it's just, it's one of the worst examples, I feel like, of, and has such a great excuse for filming in the first place on one level, but on another level, it's supposed to be a super secret mission. Why are they filming all this? But okay, fine. Maybe the Department of Defense needs all this information and they're going to destroy the footage after they look at it. I don't know, whatever. But, you know, they're filming a moon landing. But then by the end of the movie, it's like, why? Why? Why are you still filming this? Why aren't you running away from the sentient rocks, devoting all of your resources to reestablishing communication, to figuring out how to get off the planet? Like, that's it. I'm done.
Did they break out the old standard of that? Well, there's a light on my camera.
No, they do nothing. They don't. They don't even bother because they know that if they even called any attention to it, they would just make the problem worse. It just makes no sense. Yep. And it's yep. just.
I apologize to anybody out there. I know sometimes our listeners might watch the two films ahead of time. So if we subjected you to Apollo 18 and you disliked it as much as Steven did. I apologize to you for that. I just mainly for it's several ideas that I like. I don't hate it. I just maybe it's just part of it that there's just so much. There are so many whiffs, but the things that it's whiffing at, I admire.
That's a good way to say it.
All right.
I will give it. In fact, that makes it worse for me. It's one of the reasons why I get so passionate and angry about it. It's because the first 15 minutes, first 10 or 15 minutes are really, really good and establish, you know, this concept that's brilliant. And there are throughout this movie, there are so many really, really great ideas that they just, that they whiff at in ways that don't feel like, you know, some movies you can forgive for whiffing because they're trying hard and they're, you know, and this movie had plenty of resources. It just, and I don't want to say it was lazy or that it didn't care. Obviously it did, but like there's a sense in which it was just kind of like, we're just going to aim for the absolute lowest possible common denominator. And when things aren't really, when stuff doesn't make sense, we're just not going to care. We're not going to bother fixing any of this stuff. We're just going to hope that our audience is too dumb to notice all of the problems with the movie. And I'm not.
So. Yeah, I honestly, given all the extra material that is existent and the fact that it's only 73 minutes, it seems more likely to me that some people, the filmmakers probably, did care and just could not figure out a way to cobble it all together. And the distributor just said, we don't care. We got enough for a trailer.
Yep.
That's enough.
No, exactly.
And the movie was made for $5 million and made $25 million. So, you know, the fact that you and I are now talking about it 10 years later about how bad it is, I mean, everybody got paid on this one.
Yeah, no, and, you know, good for them. It, you know, at the end of the day, it's just not a very good movie.
No, it's not.
I give it an F on scientific accuracy and an F. So we have our official, we have our first double A plus and our, I think what might be our first double F.
Aha, you finally see the method to my madness. I think that I'm not even going to touch scientific accuracy. If you like sci-fi horror and found footage, there are nuggets and kernels and morsels of this movie that you will like. On the whole, I think it's a mess, but I don't think it's terrible, terrible.
I would chew my own arm off to get away from being forced to watch this movie again.
No, I would not watch it again. Three times in a lifetime is enough.
I've only seen it twice, and that was more
I
than
think
enough.
It's bad, but not wretched. You, I know, hate it. And I know a lot of horror fans, have given it more than a fair shake.
I look forward to some, I hope we get at least a couple of angry tweets mad at me for slagging on a movie that somebody loves.
Well, I love that, you know, I don't like the movie, but I do love the fact that there are people out there who can agree with all of our criticisms, but probably still like the movie. And I like that. That's good.
So there you go. One of the most scientifically accurate and artistically interesting movies of all time, paired with one of the least on both fronts. And, you know, for two movies that are in the same series, that's a wild swing in quality.
You're still sticking with that gag, huh?
I'm going to close with the same joke I opened with.
Well, on behalf of both Apollo movies, thank you guys for listening, and we'll be back soon.
Thank you guys for listening.